Brian, your flag decal won't get you into heaven anymore. We got a couple more cuts to pay tribute to John Prine, taken yesterday, way too young, 70, 72, 73, unbelievable. John White is going to join us, and it turns out that we were actually fortunate that John didn't get to John yesterday, as we usually do Monday or Tuesday, and to have his steward expertise after watching the fourth from Foner yesterday. And John, first of all, good morning. Hope you and Trace are okay.
Good morning, Steve. We're hanging in there, prisoners here in our home, and for the last couple of weeks, and what a upside down world we're having. I was particularly melancholy on Saturday when we would have had that great card at Santa Anita with the Santa Anita Derby and the Santa Anita Oaks. I was really looking forward to the Oaks with the, you know, Venetian Harbor and Donna Veloce. That would have been, that was a race I was really looking forward to. And, of course, the Derby could have been really something very good, too, with what we were looking at for that. But, of course, I mean, it's just what a mess this year for sure. And not just horse racing, but in the lives and so many countries and so many sports. And just this morning I was reading about England trying to figure out what they're going to do over there for Royal Ascot and that type of thing. So they're hoping to maybe have a Royal Ascot without spectators. And, I mean, this is a worldwide just crisis, no question about it. So, but, you know, one thing about it is I've been listening to your show, which that in itself is kind of gives us a little bit of sense of normalcy from time to time as you delve into the racing, and especially as you go back into the racing times and that type of thing. I'm holding a column that I have saved all these years from the racing times written by Bill Leggett, and it was about the fall high weight, and it's one of the I just loved that column, and it was about the kind of that the fall high weight just was a race that really made no sense. And Leggett wrote that Naira loves the fall high weight handicap, or the FHHZZZ, as some of us call it. So I guess he and some others in New York would call the fall high weight the Fizz. And he said, to be gentle about it, the Fizz is the dumbest event in thoroughbred racing and the second most idiotic sporting event in the world. The Fizz will have its 78th running this year, but just because something's been around a long time certainly doesn't make it correct. Somebody should have gotten the message right after the race's first running in 1914 when a two-year-old filly, Comley, won it under 110 pounds. Obviously, that meant nothing. The only thing of importance is Naira's continuing admiration for it. Well, as George and Ira Gershwin said, they're writing songs of love, but not for me. He says, in the Fizz, horses which should be carrying 110 to 122 pounds end up carrying 128 to 140. That's a lot of dead weight, he said, and so is the race. We will now attempt to answer your questions about the Fizz. Does the fall high weight have a bearing on anything? Nothing whatsoever. Is it a factor in voting for champion sprinter? It's the first race one throws out. How many other tracks have a Fizz? Zero. Are other tracks contemplating adding the Fizz to their schedules? Not if they are private enterprises which want to remain in business. Why is it a grade two race? The Flat Earth Society decides that, and on and on. I mean, and really when you think about it, I mean, it is. You kind of talk about archaic, and especially today, we don't even have. We got like a handful of handicaps left in North America. So, I mean, it's really archaic now, but it just was so entertaining. I remember I enjoyed the Thoroughbred Times immensely. Of course, I was working for the competitor, the Daily Racing Form, but I was constantly picking up copies of the Racing Times because, as you've pointed out, I mean, the wealth of writing talent there was just tremendous. I mean, it really was. And I just thoroughly enjoyed reading so much of the writing in it, from the Hub days to the Leggetts to so many others in there. So, and so much of the Racing Times ended up being, you know, as you pointed out, incorporated into the daily racing form, especially in terms of the past performances. And it makes me think of my late father and how he was really so far ahead of his time in a way, because back in the 1960s, I can remember, in 70s, I remember how he would, when I would look at a race after he handicapped it with his red pencil, and a lot of the things he wrote in the past performances with his red pencil, we now take for granted. I mean, he wrote the jockeys' names, just that in itself, for each horse, because the only place you could see the jockey's name was in the sweep, in the front of the form. And my dad would take the time, his first step in handicapping a race was to write the jockey's name for each horse right by the horse's name. And then he would go through there and he'd underline races where they had had run against each other. And now we have that in boldface. Nowadays we take for granted the italics where you can see a horse won next time out. But a lot of the things my dad did in time were incorporated. He would keep a whole file of forms because he would go every day during a meet, and he would keep the file, and he'd keep them for years. And this is back when we didn't have, you couldn't just look at a horse's past performances and see his record on that track or on a wet track and things like that. And so my dad and mudders back in those days in the 70s and in the 60s, we really did have mudders and horses that were outstanding wet track performers more than before we got into the sealed tracks. And we had the mud marks that are kind of a popular nostalgic aspect of horses' past performance today. And I spent many years assigning mud marks as a chart caller for the racing form. In fact, the last superior mud mark I ever assigned, which was an X in a circle, was to Biakoa. That was the last superior mud mark I ever assigned. But my dad would be able to look back at a horse's record at that track for maybe the last couple of years, or he'd look up their record on a wet track, especially when he knew it was going to rain and he would be dealing with a wet track. And that was information that was not at the fingertips of the people that had bought the form at the track that day or didn't do their homework like my father did. So that was an inspiration to me and something that I realized that it really paid off to do a lot of your own work, and I started taking my own trip notes and things like that, so back in the day. But like I say, it's very good. The Racing Times had such good past performances, and horse players have benefited from that since the racing form, after the Racing Times folded, did adopt a lot of those features.
Absolutely. John, let me get, we got about 15 minutes, and I'm sure you'll want to flesh out the DQ from Fawner. What were your thoughts? I know you saw the replay.
Well, one thing, it's kind of comforting, again, when the world's in having a major crisis, that the stewards are still getting pummeled in our sport. There's a consistency in that, whether it's Fawner Park or Saratoga or whatever it is, we seem to run into these steward controversies. I have to say, first of all, that it's interesting there was not an inquiry in this race. So similar to the Kentucky Derby of last year that was so controversial, again, it's interesting to me that but boy, it was a very quick objection. And I will say that I give the stewards credit for not just piggybacking on the objection, because that's what you will see. A lot of stewards will say, we're getting an objection, we better put up the inquiry sign too. And in a way, that's kind of a preventative measure, because, again, if you get involved into a controversy, as we saw with the Kentucky Derby last year, that became a very important controversial aspect to it, that the fact that the stewards never did put up an inquiry sign. So even if you put it up belatedly, it does kind of help the stewards to say, yeah, we put up the inquiry sign too. So sometimes you might be inclined to do that from a defensive aspect. And these stewards felt, that they were just going to address the objection. Another aspect of this is practically my entire life in racing, which stretches half a century, I've heard so many people so often say, well, it was only an objection, so I can't imagine that the number's going to come down, because unless the stewards put up the inquiry, they just don't tend to take a number down. And I have felt that all the stewards I've worked with, going clear back into the 1970s, stewards will adjudicate a race on its own merits. And a lot of times people say, well, you know, it's this person or this jockey or that. Believe me, for the 99.9% of the time, you're just looking at those replays and trying to make the best decision that you possibly can and get it right. And more than that, maybe not get it wrong. And another aspect of this race is the incident happens turning into the stretch on a 5/8 oval with sharp turns, something I'm familiar with growing up. But the track in my hometown, Playfair, was a 5/8 oval. I was a steward on a 5/8 oval at LaBoie Park, and I have worked at Los Alamitos during the time that they had not expanded that track yet, and it was a bullring too. So I've got a fair amount of bullring officiating experience. But whether it's a mile track or a 5/8 oval, a half-mile oval, or Belmont Park, whatever, that spot turning into the stretch is the trickiest spot that you have to try to judge. There's just no getting around it. And at least like at Santa Anita and the major tracks, you've got at least a fairly decent shot of what we call the quarter pole shot. And in this race, it took me back to my days as a steward at LaBoie Park in Idaho, because we really didn't have what would be the equivalent of a quarter pole shot. And I can see they really don't seem to have that at Fonder, because they didn't show us a camera angle from that shot. They showed what would be on a mile track, the equivalent to a 3/8 tower shot, which was relatively meaningless. I mean, that shot just, it didn't give you a good view to try to judge this. So you had basically only the pan. So that, and trying to make a decision with only the pan, turning into the stretch where you can't really see the horse's paths, that's the part to where if they had not made a disqualification, I could kind of understand that, because you could conceivably say, you know, the videotape did not substantiate the claim of foul because of the fact we really didn't have a good video shot of it. But I texted you a photo I took off of the video, and that's a rather damning photo. For those not wanting a disqualification, because when I didn't feel as strongly about it when they showed it in regular speed, but when they slowed it down, to me, I'm satisfied that where's Rufus, the number seven, I'm satisfied he came over without clearance. And another aspect you want to determine right off the bat, did the number two, Taylor's Prince, did he establish himself, get up in there, as we like to say? Did he get up into the hole? And his head gets to, like, the saddle top cloth of the number seven. I mean, he established his position in there. Once he's in there, he has his right to be in there and not get bothered. So now there's another part, there's a possibility, and I have run into this from time to time, where a jockey can grandstand, you know, where it really wasn't all that tight, and he stands up and makes it look good. But for that, I will give credit to the jockey, because at least he gave the steward something to hang their hat on, because it didn't look good when the guy's standing up on the horse. And, but I don't think, in my opinion, which is an opinion that you're using to make the call, in my opinion, I don't think the rider was grandstanding. I think he was worried about getting dropped, because it got very tight on him in there. And so when you just add it all up, I would have reluctantly voted for the disqualification. And why do I say reluctantly? Well, I say reluctantly because I would sure like to have a better camera angle to be able to make a call in this race. And the fact that you really only have the pan leaves a bad taste in my mouth. And we have thousands and thousands of dollars wagered at these racetracks, and really millions when you think about it, every day across the country. And yet I think our video has been very lacking in this sport. You know, you look at those Breeders' Cups and Triple Crown races where they had that blimp above, and you can see how different that can look and how really you could feel much more comfortable about making a decision off a shot like that where you're looking at them from above. But in lieu of that, you at least want to have the best camera angles that you can have at ground level. And certainly I kind of have sympathy for the stewards here in that I don't think they had exactly what I would call the best case scenario here in terms of the video to try to make the call. But the picture I sent you, when you look at the front legs, the left side of that number seven, Where's Rufus, from that shot, it does not appear to me there's very much space at all between him and the inside rail, which indicates to me that he did come over without clearance and came close to maybe dropping that horse. So my vote would have been for a disqualification.
You know, I appreciate it, John, and the way you discuss it and the elements that you introduce to the conversation, I hope it helps people who, you know, thought it was just a ridiculous takedown. I want people to understand what the mental process is. And Chris Katulak actually went as far as reading the rule that is referenced. And, I know people get frustrated that, you know, there's 37 jurisdictions and, you know, there's nuances from, you know, from spot to spot. And, you know, for years, there's been the debate, frankly, on both coasts, a foul is a foul, or, you know, is there more leeway? The herding, and this is the opposite, of course, of herding, which is crowding. And,
right.
You know, I'm glad you're the third person, you know, including from Chris and then with Nick Tamaro, that addressed the 5/8 portion of the equation, because, you know, we're used to, you know, ovals that are much more sweeping and, you know, where they're, you know, they're banking provides some support in many cases, you know, for the horses to maintain their lines, you know. But when it comes to, you know, when it comes to the bull ring style, it's a lot of cowboying going on.
Well, that's exactly right. And in fact, another track I worked at that I had forgotten, that was a 5/8 oval. It was actually a 5/8 oval with half mile turns, because I had worked at Fairplex calling charts there when it was a half-mile oval, and when they enlarged it to make it like a Los Alamitos when it was a 5/8, or LeBlanc Park, they were built as 5/8, so they had actual 5/8 turns, whereas Fairplex and Playfair in my hometown, they were half-mile ovals that were stretched from side to side, and so they basically kept the half-mile turns and enlarged the track that way. And so those were rather sharp turns. And I was a steward at Fairplex with Randy Winnick and with Daryl McCarg, who is now the chief steward in the state of California. And there's just no question that you're going to run into more incidents on a track, you know, that's a 5/8 oval than on a nice mile racetrack. That's part of what makes mile racetracks good, is that you get cleaner racing. This is the problem you run into turf racing a lot of times. Not only do the horses run closer together because of the fact that they'll bunch up without dirt being thrown back in their face, as opposed to running on the dirt where they spread out more, but the turf courses we have in our country are almost always put inside the mile oval, and so you're dealing with, again, more or less bull rings on the turf. So that's why you're going to run into more incidents generally in turf racing in the United States than on dirt racing in the United States.
I appreciate that perspective as well. It was too bad. I mean, pure and simple, nobody wants to have that included in such a high-profile sequence, but you know, we've got the game, and it doesn't matter if it's in this scenario, or whether it's the Breeders' Cup Classic and the Kentucky Derby. I mean, how is this any different? And you know, that's what's funny. One of the funniest things about the reaction, and I know a lot of people are reacting, you know, literally instantaneously and expressing frustration and you know, you just lost $72 or $120, whatever you put into it. And you get, you know, your hits, as we say in Yiddish. But, you know, the comment that, oh, it's because it's a podunk track and it's a C track and it's these the half-wit Stewart. Whoa. We've had the same annoyance, frustration, and carrying on at the absolute highest level. So don't be dismissive and insulting to people who have been lifelong. And I'm going to guess, you know, Bob Pollock, and maybe Dennis Kochever as well. I mean, they've been stalwarts and involved in, you know, RCI for decades. I mean, these are people that were at Exarban. I mean, for those that don't remember, Exarban was, I think, the seventh largest track and handle in the country. And Bob Pollock, you know, was one of the stewards, and so was Kochever. I mean, you're talking about people that have been, you know, adjudicating races for decades.
I stopped off at Exarban on my way to Louisiana Downs from the Pacific Northwest in 1976. It was early August. It was like over 100 degrees in Omaha, but I enjoyed. I went to the races there 2 days, and Jack Vanberg won. Won the feature race on Saturday, and that was a huge crowd there. They had a whole area of the track that was with the buses of the people that they bussed in from all over the Midwest. I mean, it was quite a sight just to see the rows of buses that you would see at Exarban. And I'm really glad that I stopped. I stopped it there and at the Centennial in Denver on my way to Louisiana Downs. But one thing I will say, when people want to try to knock the smaller tracks, and I guess maybe I'm a little sensitive to this because I grew up, not only Long Acres was a major track, but like Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and was a small track, and Playfair really was a small track, really. But when I have worked as a racing official, like at Boise, some people would say, well, it's only a $1,000 claiming race or what have you, and I would tell the people, I'd say, look, that race to the participants in that race is just as important to them as it is to somebody at Santa Anita in a $100,000 stakes race or a $500,000 stakes race. And I say that because those people are trying to eke out a living. And that race can mean the difference between paying bills and your rent and so forth to
well
these
put.
People.
Well
I mean,
put.
These people are putting their heart and soul and everything they've got to just try to make the race meet go and trying to survive. And but I know there have been racing officials that might step in there and maybe especially somebody coming from a bigger time to a smaller track and not have the attitude and think, well, this is only podunk down, so who cares? Well, I'll tell you what, I care, and I especially cared from a safety standpoint, that you want as safe a racing as humanly possible. And I have felt that ever since I was first a steward in 1979. In fact, I got them to stop the Ferris wheel that was going during the 2 weeks of the fair meet because, well, what was interesting is I just happened to notice that a number of horses seemed to be reacting when they were turning for home. And so, you know, and I didn't make a big deal out of this or whatever, but I went down to the jock's room the next day, and I asked some of the seasoned jockeys down there, and I said, hey, are you having any incidents out there on the track? And I didn't want to be too specific because I wanted them to bring up what I had been seeing.
How about that?
And like three, four of them said, you know, I wish they'd get them to stop that Ferris wheel from turning during the fair because our horses are kind of spooking from that. And I said, I will look into it. And I called the general manager of the track, and I said, hey, look, we got a safety issue here. See if you can call the general manager of the fair and get them to stop running that Ferris wheel. Give them a schedule of our races or during the race day or whatever, but see if you can get it to where that thing is not moving during the time that we are running
a race. How about that?
And And so he did, they did, and the jockeys were thankful for that. But see, I'm one of the ilk that if you can have a problem that you can prevent, you know, Bertie Handel once said, hey, I deal with problems once they become a problem. I take the opposite view. I any problem I can possibly nip in the bud at all, I'm going to try to do it because I don't want there to be the accident and then you react to the accident. I want to try to prevent the accident. So I was very proud to have accomplished that. But, you know, and this safety issue is more paramount now in our sport than it's ever been. And so when you see that incident turning into the stretch at Fawner Park yesterday, that's an element of this too, because that was a little dicey, a little borderline dangerous there. That guy, it wouldn't have been impossible for that guy on Taylor's Prince, the number two, to possibly go down. And you don't want, don't need that in our sport right now.
No, especially, no, not at all. But it, you know, it's part of, it's just part of the action. I just, listening in is Eric Hamelbeck from HBPA as well as, you know, Eric has the role when it comes to ROPE, the Racing Officials Accreditation Program, and he really appreciates the way you broke this out and you know, the elements that you brought out, John. So thanks from that standpoint. John, we're going to certainly have a three-year-old race to talk about in the recap next week when it comes to this group that's coming together for the Oakland Stakes. So we'll look for that. And in the meantime, I'm sure you're keeping track of Lo Sal and God bless Doc Allred and Bob Marino and the team at Lo Sal, who seem to have a better relationship with Orange County than and a little bit more sway with Orange County. So,
well, the thing we've been baffled about is how the Los Angeles County Board of Health, Public Health, can close down Santa Anita, but yet the Los Angeles County Arboretum, which the Los Angeles County operates right across the street from Santa Anita, is open for business, and they're charging people and making money. And it made me come to the thought that it's too bad Santa Anita couldn't call up the Arboretum and say, do you have a big patch of grass over there or something that we could, like, put chalk marks down on the ground and bring some cameras over and do some racing? So you're going to be open for business across the street. Maybe we could run our races across the street over there at your Arboretum.
There you go. We're going to talk tomorrow. There's a couple of stories that when we talk to Hammer, I haven't had a chance. I've been saving it because I knew we would talk to him. But there is the difficulty, the added difficulty, too, about the shortfall in California's workman's compensation program and trainers hit with a $1,230 bill per horse. So this is quarterly. This is not an annual. Some venues are 6 months or annual, but this is a quarterly bill. And boy, I mean, just comes at the absolute. I mean, it's partially responsible because there is no, you know, purse accounts to be utilizing right now. But this, we're gonna talk about it tomorrow with Hammer. John, thanks so much. Stay safe.
Thanks very much, Steve. Take care.
John White, everybody. Post time, John. We've got really probably our last break of the morning. And if you've been with us from the start, it's been devoted to John Prine. And we got a couple more cuts. We're going to close out with Hello in There, which really feels so, you know, perfectly in tune with the situation, you know, nation and worldwide. Prine, beside, you know, growing up as a young child in Illinois, in Maywood, actually, moved to Paradise, Kentucky, with his family, and one of his really lasting songs that has got you know, environmental overtones, Paradise. And I thought it was important to get it in as well today. So take our last break. Seth Merrow is going to join us next, but here's John Prine, Paradise.
When I was a child, my family would travel down to western Kentucky, where my parents were born. And there's a backwards old town that's often remembered so many times that my memories are worn. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where paradise lay. Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away. Well, sometimes we travel right down the Green River to the abandoned old prison down by Avery Hill, where the air smelled like snakes, we'd shoot with our pistols, but empty pop bottles was all we would kill. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where paradise lay. Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away. Then the coal company came with the world's largest shovel, and they tortured the timber and stripped all the land. Well, they dug for their coal till the land was forsaken. Then they rode it all down as the progress of man. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where paradise lay. Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away. When I die, let my ashes float down the Green River. Let my soul roll on up to the Rochester Dam. I'll be halfway to heaven with paradise waiting, just 5 miles away from wherever I am. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where paradise lay. Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away.
John Prine, Paradise. The coal company came with the world's largest shovel, and they tortured the timber and stripped all the land. Well, they dug for their coal till the land was forsaken, then they wrote it all down as the progress of man. John Prine. Seth Merrow standing by with us to close out what's been an interesting morning. Seth, how you doing?
Good, good. Hanging in. Made my weekly grocery shopping trip this week. Man, this Susie Homemaker thing is now working for me. I'm an eat out kind of guy.
Yeah.
So now to go out and load up the, and even when I wasn't eat out, it was typically, you know, 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock rolls around. What do I want for dinner today? I'd roll over to the supermarket and buy the three things and come home. Now I'm loading up the shopping cart and hunkering in for 7 or 10 days.
Well, and give everybody a peek into the gustatorial splendor of Shea Merrow. What has been typically on the menu?
I do a pretty good beef stew. And
nice.
The nice thing about that is you can then freeze a couple. So you get a couple extra meals. I do a chicken and rice thing that's pretty good. I'm trying to think. Those may be my two most complicated. Other than that, you fry up some ground beef and throw some ragu, and you have like a meat sauce sandwich. That's one of my easy ones.
Like almost like a sloppy Joe. We had sloppy Joes the other night.
Yeah. So that, you know, I mean, it's that type of thing. I don't do anything, you know, I don't do like a Coco Van or anything like that. I have, you know, nothing like that is on the menu.
I love it. No, very nice. We did our first grill, the first grilling of the season.
I miss not having the grill. I miss that. Used to like doing some lamb chops out on the grill. Yeah.
All right, I'll remember this summer when you come out to the when we have our party. Of course, last year I could not do my usual Saratoga, you know, summer dinner party because I was, you know, I was prone.
Couldn't see the grill.
Exactly. But we'll remember. I'll get you some of those little lollipop lamb chops. You like those?
I don't think I've ever had those.
Oh, the little tiny ones, like you get as an appetizer with the, you know, you use the bone as a handle and.
You know. Oh, no, I don't think I've ever had it, but it sounds good.
All right. There you go. Well, I Ushak's continues to do a tremendous job, Denny Ushak in Shushan. And you've heard me talk about many times and, was out to Denny yesterday. I got, the one thing I forgot to get was a chicken. I need to make soup somehow today. It is Passover, and let me quickly because we're going to have we're going to close out with "Hello in There" from John Prine, which is about 4.5 minutes, and so I know I'll be tight for time. I want to make sure to wish everybody that's celebrating a very good Pesach tonight, getting started, and it's such a strange circumstance that. You know, a holiday like Passover, and certainly on Sunday at Passover, you know, Easter, essentially, you know, they come together. They're an entry, Easter and Passover, and are both so family oriented and welcoming, and, you know, celebrations of you know, of family, and you know, particularly when it comes to Passover, you know, it's a celebration of. The exodus from Egypt and being released from bondage at the hands of the Egyptians, and yet we're all captive. So it's there's a very unusual dialectic going on for Passover this year. But collectively, as a people, you know, to everybody, I hope you're with. Some friends that and family that can share it with you tonight and tomorrow night, and best wishes.
Yeah, I'll go along with that. Everybody, that's probably the first time in history that the Passover and Easter have been claimed as an entry. But I think you're absolutely right. a religious entry on the calendar. So wish everybody that. And as always, I sat down. I didn't watch the whole thing, but I always enjoy the. This holiday season, the Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston. Moses.
Edward G. Robinson in there is my favorite. Where's your Messiah now?
See? Yeah. Moses, see? One of the great casting choices of all time.
Yes. Yeah. Unbelievable. Let's turn and get some racing in. We've got about, call it about 12 minutes, Seth. Did you participate in the Fonner Pick 5 yesterday?
I've been putting picks up on Twitter, some traction, mainly Wednesday through Sunday. But with the big carryover, I put up Fonner. And then when push came to shove, I just couldn't narrow the ticket down. I thought it was a little too competitive, so I didn't jump in. And as it wound up, I had the horse that was moved up in the first leg. I had that horse at the bottom of my mix, but I don't think I would have gone that deep in that race, so I probably would have been knocked out there. And, yeah, you know, I heard you talking to John White and saw the reaction to the race. To me, it was a bad call. I would have gone 80-20 the other way, but it would have been 80-20. I don't think it was egregious by any means, but it just seemed like a bad place on the track for the jockey to try to get up inside. And the horse that won enough. As they came down the stretch, I said, if the two doesn't hold on, then watch out for a DQ. But I thought with him holding on for second, I thought, man, leave the results the way they were.
Well, and I told people, and I opened the show, I don't know if you were listening early, but I've always appreciated your approach when it comes to that 80-20, 70-30, 65-35, you know, you 50-50. You were the first person I knew that sort of quantified calls like that. And my number was 70-30. And
yeah.
So you went even further, 80-20. Even Chris Katulak, who joined us earlier, Chris, you know, was 60-40 for leaving the winner up. I thought that you absolutely, in fact, the two finishing the way he did after virtually coming to a stop, I thought actually lent itself quite a bit to the DQ. I mean, the fact that, you know, that he was able to stay on and hold off those that were rallying, trying to rally wide. Listen, I got taken down, and I wasn't surprised. You know, you can tell if they don't adjudicate in 90 seconds, maybe 2 minutes and change, if they don't dismiss a call, you know it's getting massaged around, and that they're, you know, and then they kept showing whatever angle they could. And the more I looked at it, the more I understood. I called it, you know, marginally understandable.
Yeah,
I thought it was a ticky-tack call.
You made the you know, the point that it happens everywhere. I mean, Twitter flipped out. And it happens everywhere. We see it every day.
Sure.
No matter the size of the circuit, there are bad calls we complain about all the time. Or I won't necessarily say bad call in that, again, I thought it was 80-20. I didn't think it was egregious. So it was a call we disagree with, and maybe the majority disagrees with. It happens everywhere. It was just, and you said this as well, it was just unfortunate, the situation. I mean, Foner has all eyes on it, eyes of the race. They put $3 million into that at Foner. So all eyes of the racing world were on it. It had to be the first leg. Had it been the last leg, the majority of people might have been knocked out already and really would have kind of shrugged at the decision. But it was the first leg. People were jumping in. So it was just, it was unfortunate that it kind of played out the way it did.
All right, let's get we got to go out at 11:54 or so. So we got about 7.5 minutes, Seth. I assume Tampa is your focus today. We talked to Nick Tamaro earlier, went through the sequence, $81,000 pick five carryover. Give everybody your approach to this sequence.
We start in race four. I like the 13. The 13 is scratched. I was hoping that horse would get in. I was going to maybe lean on that. I have a kind of a little ticket put together. I'm too deep in the first leg. 4, 5, 3, 6 for me in the first leg. She knew me. I have to draw a line, obviously, through the last race. But I think that, you know, it looks kind of like an aberration. So I'm going to look for that one to rebound to a better effort and noble intentions. I just like this horse popping over from Gulfstream and picking up Dan Santino. I think noble intentions will be a little bit live in there as well. So again, I have a 4, 5, 3, 6, but I think I'm going to lean on the ticket on the 4, 5. Fifth race, I have it 6, 10, 4, and 9. And again, I'm just putting a kind of a fairly modest ticket together. I couldn't find any singles, so I'll just go too deep in here. 6, 10, 4, and 9, the number 6, Gone as a Girl Can Get. Showed some early speed last time and just got caught. I mean, this is an angle I've heard you talk about over the years. Shows that line of ones in the last race and just gets caught. And sometimes the next race, that speed holds up. And so I'm kind of going to kind of rely on that, on an extra little class drop as well. So we'll toss the 6 on top and Katie Faluna in the second spot. The last few races have been pretty good. This is not a strong field. You're just looking for some numbers that have a little bit of life, and I think both of those two do. So I'm going to lean on those. 6 and the 10, have it 6, 10, 4, 9 in the fifth. Sixth race, I'll go 4 deep. There's a couple of legs where I'm going to go 4 deep. And as the day goes along, I may try to pare down. I'd love to lose like one horse from my sequence to make it even a little less expense. I mean, it's not really an expensive ticket to begin with, but I'd love to cut one out. But I'll go 4 deep here, 4, 5, 6, and 2. Barrel of Destiny on top. get some class relief. This is a New York bred, spent much of last year, certainly the spring through the summer, against New York breds and New York allowance company, came down to Tampa, put in a couple of decent tries against better, so I think the class relief will be a little bit of a wake-up. Monkey Mind hasn't been seen since mid-January, but on a best effort, and this one also has a little bit of early speed. I like the top pick, is going to get a little bit of class relief. It's a gimme's girl. It's just obviously this season it's hard to ignore anything that Bennett and Camacho are sending out. This one comes out of a win in a similar event last time. The numbers are maybe a little light, the buyers as compared to the top two, but again, with this team, Bennett and Camacho didn't want to leave that one out. And Cape La-Di-Da, Mike Deaney trains. He trained the nice firster I liked last week.
That's right.
Down at Tampa. And I like, he's been having a good meet, so I'm kind of paying attention to anything he sends out. An 8-1, I thought Cape La-Di-Da might be a little bit of a player. So again, I'll use all four in the sixth. 4, 5, 6, and 2. I'll go two deep again in race 7. I have a 9-7, 4-1, but I'll use the 9 and the 7. Amelia's Wild Ride. It was interesting. I knew the name, and I looked it up last night as I was handicapping. Amelia's Wild Ride beat the talented Ben's Cat 5 years ago at Penn National in a stakes race. But now comes back as a 9-year-old, drops down, comes over from Gulfstream. So I'll put Amelia's Wild Ride on top. Big Gillette has some back numbers that are pretty good. Clearly very lightly raced over the past 2 years. But I thought maybe with the comebacker under the belt, a little bit of additional class relief, maybe we can get, not to those real numbers we're seeing underneath, but at least maybe split the difference a little bit and get in the mix. So I'll rely on those two. But again, this is a race where deep down is interesting. I'm a Wildcat, I think, can bounce back as well. But to keep the ticket affordable, I'll go a couple of deep in here. I have a 9-7, 4-1. We'll use the 9 and the 7. And in the finale, I'm going to go 4 deep again. The horse I really like on the card is Gaelic Gold. I have a 9-3, 10-2. I'm not going to say it's a clever pick just because Clement is doing so well when he comes over to Tampa and doing well with first-time starters also. So by Giants Causeway, Gaelic Gold. This is a New York bred and has a couple of siblings. One of the siblings ran second in the career debut, won the second start up at Saratoga back in 2016. Another sibling called Seafoam ran second the first 3 starts of the career, then won a couple of races, including a New York bred stake. So I think there's a little bit of precociousness in here. And as they say, Clement doing well when he comes over and also well with firsters. So Gaelic Gold on top. But I thought Screen Image at 12-1 on the morning line and Clear as Day 7-2. I could have gone either way with those and originally had Screen Image in the second spot, but eventually I moved Clear as Day up. I just think on maybe better recent form. But off the seasonal debut, which wasn't much, but there are some back numbers, and it was a decent little number in the seasonal debut, although well beaten that day. I just thought Screen Image might be a player at a price. And then Heavenly Peace, second-time starter for Eddie Keneally, who, again, I thought the last race was enough of a foundation to maybe build on a little bit. So I'll use all 4 of those. As I say, as I get into the afternoon, I may try to pair one horse out of the mix. But I have this last race at Tampa, 9-3, 10-2.
Well, we talked to Ken Sweezy yesterday, and Ken's got Finest Jewel in the first leg and Screen Image in the last leg. This is a surprisingly strong group. 18,000 maiden, and when you see Shug in there and Chris Clement and Nacho Correas and Stidham and Keneally, it's a tough group. Well, Seth, for those that haven't been watching, Seth is putting up a one sheet, capital OTB style, analysis as much as he can and as the action dictates, and a little Gulfstream, little Tampa, little Oaklawn, and so forth. Seth, stay safe. Please try to eat. We don't want to find you in that, we don't want to find you in those rooms. We want to, bust the door down.
I didn't mention, besides the chicken and the beef stew, I'm also doing the little quick baked cookies and brownies. So I'm covered.
Seth Merrow, everybody, maybe send him a care package. We'll get him through this.
Good luck to everybody.
Seth Merrow, everybody. Seth Merrow, 2 on your Twitter machine and a capital OTB. I want to thank Casey with a great job pulling together the John Prine music. And, of course, Chris Katulak to start us off, Nick Tamaro, Sid Fernando, John White, and Seth. Andrew Hawkins maybe tomorrow. We also owe Pete, and tomorrow we'll have visits from Steve and Tony and Rich Ang and more. Happy Passover again, everybody. And we'll close out our tribute to John Prine with Hello in There, really about isolation. And certainly we can all identify. Stay safe today, everybody. I'll talk to you in the morning.
racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Have you heard about the new handicapping and betting app that is sweeping the nation? It's called First Bet, and it puts the power of AI-assisted handicapping, seamless wagering, and live HD video in the palm of your hand. Thousands of bettors have already made First Bet their way to handicap, bet, and watch more than 300 of the world's top tracks. Isn't it time for you to join them? And when you give First Bet a try today, you can cash in on a huge welcome bonus. Sign up with promo code SPORTOFKINGS, all one word, and you will get $10 just for joining, as well as a 10% rebate, up to $500 for your first 30 days. With that much free cash on the line, what do you have to lose? Get started at first.com/bet. That's number1st.com/bet. And don't forget promo code SPORTOFKINGS when you sign up. And if you already have an ExpressBet account, you're way ahead of the game. Simply log into FirstBet using your username and password, and you're off to the races.
Up to 18 years old and 21 years old in certain states to open an account with FirstBet and reside in a state where such activity is legal. Void or prohibited. National Gaming Support Line 800-522-4700.